Across its multiple versions, Minecraft has achieved a success that most developers wouldn't dream of. With over 176 million copies sold, it's the best-selling video game of all time as I record this podcast, leaving even its closest rivals, Tetris and GTA 5, in the dust. But it all started a decade ago from humble roots in the form of an experiment by Marcus Persson, best known as Notch. Then titled Cave Game, it was far simpler than the Minecraft we know today, though it still laid the groundwork for gameplay that remains important. Creative building with basic blocks. By its first full release in 2011, Minecraft featured different modes, a greatly expanded world of possibilities, and crafting, a mechanic so influential that it's become ubiquitous since. The subjective, open atmosphere of Minecraft is well suited to C418's lush soundtrack, which has continued to grow with the game itself. Its spacious melodies, rich pianos, and bubbling ambience are perfect for exploration and building, and new tracks continue to be added when they're called for, like the update Aquatic. After the brand was sold to Microsoft in 2014, a series of console ports hit the market, bringing with them heaps of downloadable content. From minigames to mythology mashups, the majority of these feature brand new soundtracks by Gareth Coker, who has also worked on titles like Ark, The Unspoken, and Ori and the Blind Forest. I'm Lee Tyrrell, and this is The Sound Test, where I look in depth into video game audio and music, along with the very people who crafted it. For this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking to C418 about his unique work for Minecraft. I also spoke to Gareth Coker about his masses of music for its DLC, which juggles several styles and sounds. But long before looking at anything Microsoft did with the franchise, it makes sense to go back to the start. Though eventually assisted by a small team, Minecraft began as one of Notch's simple prototypes. So how and when did C418, who had essentially no experience in composing game music, join the project?
It was actually quite random. So back then, I wanted to learn English. That was definitely a drive. And also, I liked free video games. And the connection of both of them was TixSource at the time. TixSource is TIG Source. It is an indie game forum that still exists to this date. It's not as active as it used to be back then, but it was basically like a collection of like the first like big indie group, like I don't know, like Phil Fish, Edmund McMillan, that kind of group. I was hanging out in the Tick IRC channel, and I think at the time I was obsessed with making music. Like I've done it for like maybe 4 years at that time or so, and I liked showing off my stuff there. And I think Notch, like he actually also made music at the time, but like I think he wasn't as confident in making music, so like he asked me if I wanted to help him out with his prototype, which was Minecraft at the time, back then it was nothing. It was just an engine that throws random blocks and you can jump around, and the jumping was solid. That's pretty much it. I think I was interested because I liked the ideas that he was throwing at me, so I was totally down to do it.
Thank you. When C418 came on board, Minecraft was in a stage known by fans as early classic creative. This refers to versions of the game released in late May 2009. In these builds, only the most rudimentary of mechanics, like destroying and placing blocks, were possible, with some huge features like crafting still to come. Minecraft was finding its feet. So how much direction did C418 get from its main developer, Notch, when it came to music?
None. I was giving all of the direction. I remember very specifically that like I recorded some part of the game and like putting audio over it, just like my own audio, like with footsteps and like sound design and all of that. And just like, this is what I imagined a game could maybe sound like. And back at the time, neither Notch nor I knew about like middleware sound engines like Wise or FMod. So it was all rough and tumble. I was playing it a lot. Like at some point, it was actually kind of sickening how long I played it. It's like, oh, it's technically work because this is my game. I work on this, but I should go to bed.
Without any real creative direction from Notch, C418 was left to decide Minecraft's musical palette for himself. Most game composers are given intimate and detailed briefs for well-developed concepts, but C418 was instead given a chance to let his music live and breathe as the title itself took form. Beyond playing early builds to gain a feel for the game, he only had his own influences to go on.
So as a teenager, when it comes to video games, I think I was obsessed with games like Rayman and Earthworm Jim, Final Fantasy VII. And then also my brother had an extensive list of pirated music that I listened to, which was a lot of random stuff that I actually genuinely didn't enjoy because he was like into minimal techno and I wasn't really. But I think I got stuck on Aphex Twin, like he had a CD full of that kind of stuff, and I really liked that stuff. So I guess ultimately my influence is really abstract video game music that is not video gamey. The funny thing is, when Aphex Twin came back like and made music in 2014 or whatever it was, he had an interview. Like Skrillex had the chance to ask him a question of like, is there anything that you think like people got influenced you by or something like that? And like he was like, so my kids played this Minecraft game and I think that guy stole my music.
Aphex Twin is most often associated with glitchy rhythms and fast-paced beats, but soft piano and ambience are also signature features of his sound. Of course, both are used prominently throughout Minecraft's OST too. Ambience, at times to the point of pure silence, sets Minecraft's music apart from other soundtracks. When themes do play, they usually take a restrained step back, leaning on lone pianos and isolated synths. As a large part of C418's approach, where did his affinity for minimalism come from?
You know what? Actually, around that time, I was not very much into ambient at all. Like people like assumed that I was listening to like Satie and Brian Eno and all that kind of stuff, and I just really wasn't. Like I only did it after the fact when everyone told me that I'm ripping them off. Like, the more I realized that this is something I enjoy, the more I honed into it. Like, back then, I wasn't even that into ambient, but then, like, I realized, oh, there's something really interesting about just, like, removing everything and, like just having the bare minimum of, like, what could be interesting. Like, just a recording of a piano, and that could already just be really fun to listen to. And, yeah, I think with Minecraft, I, like, started to realize that this is something that I really, really want to, like, research for most of my life, essentially. At the time, chiptune was very popular, and that's exactly what I wasn't trying to do. I was just sick of chiptune music in indie games. I wanted none of it.
At first, C418 only tested out a handful of tracks. Calm 1, 2 and 3 were the only tunes in the game until updates in 2010 started adding more. Each is a soothing blanket of synthesized strings, pianos and kalimba-like sounds, though we'll take a closer look at that instrument soon. Since their inclusion on the first official soundtrack album, Volume Alpha, the three Calm tracks have become known as Minecraft, Clark, and Sweden, respectively. It's clear how much those founding compositions influenced the whole OST to come, and that sense of thematic familiarity was intentional from the start.
I don't even have the original files for the Minecraft song. Back then, backupping wasn't one of my strong suits. But I remember that I wanted to make it... I think I wanted to try something repetitive, and I wanted it to be pentatonic and like very calm. I think I only had like 6 channels in that song. Like, I really tried to keep it as simple as possible, and then, like, I did that song, and I think Marcus liked it, so I did the other 2 songs, which were essentially the same project, but, like the Minecraft song removed, and, like, I kept all of the, like, instrumentations and just, like, made Sweden in that. I had, like, this little environment of, like, I want this specific reverb and this specific sound, and I want it to happen over and over again. So I had an intention of making it, like, thematic in some way. That's all I remember, I think.
Besides their general minimalism, Calm 1, 2 and 3 are linked by their use of instrumentation, which continued as C418 expanded Minecraft's OST. Pianos, albeit occasionally warped, crop up throughout his work on the game and tend to feature the melodic meat of a piece. But the pianos themselves can vary greatly in sound and timbre, sometimes sitting raw and untouched, and other times glistening with careful production.
It was actually kind of a mix. Like, some of the pianos are sampled, and then some of the pianos are, like, I had a couple uprights that I recorded, and I mostly recorded them for the terrible noises that they make, like the creaking and the hitting of the, like, hammers and that kind of stuff. And, like, I actually, like, intentionally mixed in noise so that, like, the piano actually sounds dirtier and, like, badly played almost, you know, and I really like that sound. It's like not music, it's noise, but like it adds to like the ambience of the music. I don't know, it's like a weird psychological trick, and I love it. That's why some of the like songs in the game itself, like the pianos, are just like horror. They sound kind of horrible and like essentially I put them through a guitar amp, and I just love that sound because like it makes something as simple as a piano like sound weird and like kind of creepy in a way, and it's I love that stuff. I guess I like that kind of feeling. It's probably because I'm a very angsty boy.
The three pieces that C418 first contributed all feature a memorable theme in their piano parts. However, unlike what we're used to hearing in VGM, those themes unravel slowly at a pace that better matches Minecraft's freedom. The tunes themselves are daringly understated, but after repeated plays in-game, the melodies seep in on an almost unconscious level.
I'm still figuring out why I'm so obsessed about minimalism, and I think I'm starting to get a hunch as to why I like it. So there's this book called On Repeat, which is a study that talks about how there is a likelihood that pretty much all music that we like, we only like because we have heard it over and over again. Easy example is like John Williams' Star Wars music. Like purely technically it's brilliant music, we know that, but like do we know that we like it because it's in a popular movie or and like repeated all over and over again, or like why do we like it really, right? So like that's why I'm obsessed over like minimalism and like repeating things and like trying to like compress everything to like the as few notes as possible, because I want to like figure out like how little is enough to be interesting, and like that has been like I've been obsessed over that for like forever essentially.
Minimalism is inherent in Minecraft's soundtrack, but the game is just as likely to go one step further and leave you with complete silence. Then, as you play, soft melodies seem to fade in and out of the underlying quiet, allowing your own footsteps and tool clinks to take the form. It's an unusual decision, and strikingly effective in practice. So where did the concept of total quiet in the score come from?
Like even like the way we designed the music to be played in the game was also a happy accident. I think at the time it was like something like I made like maybe 30 or 20 minutes of music, and I was like, we don't have that much music. We should just like play it sparingly and randomly in like maybe like the 15 minute pauses in between. I think I was also kind of like dealing with the dread of like, oh my God, people are playing this game for 400 hours and there is never enough music that I can make. Like even if I have thousands of hours of music in the game, it's not going to be enough because at some point people will be bored by it because they play. It's not a game that you can finish, so you just keep playing forever. So I think, yeah, I had a clear intention in like keeping it simple and like having minimalism and like having like space, like just empty space, and like having that be important. What ended up happening is that like because the music was so sparingly, every time it happened, it seemed very special to people, even if nothing really happened, even if you just like, I don't know, just dug a hole. And like just because the music was playing at that moment, they remember it. That's really fascinating. And like I still wonder to this day like why that is so addicting to people.
An addictive quality can definitely be found in Minecraft's sound effects, which fill the silence when music fades. Almost every individual noise in the game is distinctive and clear, from the clanks of your tools to the many mobs you encounter, both friendly and otherwise. A simple task like collecting resources is made rewarding and pleasurable by the sound design that comes with it, such as the famous plopping that accompanies gathering items.
It's funny because, like, I think I definitely made that plopping sound. I do remember that. And I am shocked that to hear that sound in so many video games nowadays. Like, I influenced everyone to make a plop sound by picking things up. At that time, I was a complete amateur in sound design. I used a lot of free sound, for example, and like I was just like, what could sound okay? Like, and then like the first thing I found was like walking on grass, and that sound was basically like somebody eating cornflakes, and it was obnoxious. It's still in the game. I think it's the sound that you do when you dig grass. But then I learned, oh, the way you make a like footstep for grass, you take tape. And you just like spool it out and you just step on that. And that's what like Foley designers do for grass sound effects. All of that stuff I kind of had to like teach myself, because I also honestly wasn't paid well enough to like just buy Foley's library. So I had to do everything myself. And I think that was actually a really good learning experience. At the time, I wasn't trying to make it addictive sounding. I was trying to make it like not obnoxious. That was my goal. I just had a Zoom H2, at that time I was the cheapest microphone you could get, and that's pretty much all I used. Almost all sound effects were made with that Zoom, and I just like layered tons and tons of like random things that I recorded in my parents' apartment.
It's all the more impressive what C418 achieved in Minecraft with somewhat rudimentary equipment, and as his debut game. C418 nailed the title's atmosphere and helped define its appeal from his very first inclusion. So what's his history with production? What were the steps he took in learning his trade?
I had all that MTV Music Maker and that kind of stuff. But like none of that actually influenced or like inspired me to make music. Like EJ, for example, I think it is a glorified software to look at somebody's stems, essentially. And I think it's a nice way to look into like how could I have possibly made the music, and that's pretty much it. I wonder if that influenced me in any way, because like the way I got into music was really goddamn silly. Back then I had like a bunch of friends, and like we found there was like some like worst song on a Planet MP3 file on the internet, and we listened to that and we were like, we could probably do way worse. So I just downloaded Ableton and like I went to town and like just put MP3s over MP3s and like made just like a horrible environment. But that was entertaining to me, so I didn't stop like futzing with Ableton, and I'm still playing with it to this day. So that's really my humble beginning, I guess. My brother was into making music at the time too, but like he was into like trackers, which were impenetrable to me and are still somewhat impenetrable, because I cannot for the love of God work in hex code. but like I still look into it and like see like how did they make this 50 kilobyte song and it sounds so modern. Like I'm still fascinated by that kind of stuff.
After his earliest experiments, C418 eventually settled on Ableton Live as his program of choice. An incredibly versatile digital audio workstation, Ableton has traditionally been favoured by DJs and bands who utilise live samples. However, it can be put to equally good use in the home for sequencing and general production. Throughout Minecraft's ever-evolving OST, Ableton has remained C418's choice of workstation and certainly influenced his composition.
Yes, I've never changed my Ableton addictiveness. Yeah, like I always use Ableton Live. I think at the time when it came to music, I used a lot of Kontakt, native instruments, obviously. But I also had an extensive like collection of analog synthesizers that I used like a lot. I don't use them as much anymore because I travel now, so it's impossible to carry like a heavy Moog around.
Synths and pianos make up the lion's share of music in Minecraft, but there's a lot more going on too. C418 mixed several interesting instruments into his soundtrack, from the metallic tines of hang drums to music boxes and more. As a big fan of Sonic Couture libraries, many of their instruments can be heard in-game. But one of the most prominent is a type of thumb piano, or kalimba, which C418 often uses together with piano.
It's Array and Bierod, which I had very briefly. And I recorded a lot of it, and sometimes I mix it with like the Sonic Couture library, obviously. I did a back and forth. The thing about the Array and Bierod that you cannot experience unless you actually stand in front of one is that the low notes vibrate in your tummy. It's really pleasant.
As much as Minecraft's sound is defined by its instrumentation and production, the melodic content of the music itself is just as important. The soundtrack makes wonderful use of motifs, which can sometimes show up in unexpected places. As just one example, Calm 1, from the first three tracks ever included, was later used as a basis for menu music, part of the credits, and shows up in the end, an unsettling other dimension that pays homage to no less than 11 Minecraft themes in its score.
That's probably why we remember so much of like 90s like movies, like Jurassic Park and all those kind of movies, because all of those movies, like, they had leitmotifs going on, like a melody for every single character and every single like scenario, and they keep repeating them because every time they show up on screen you repeat that melody. That doesn't really happen nowadays anymore, or like leitmotifs are just like two notes because Hans Zimmer made that popular. So like I think there's something to like 90s movies and like the repetition of melodies that we don't really have nowadays anymore, and I kind of want to bring it back. I just kind of wanted to do that over and over again and like kind of hide it everywhere in the game a little bit, and I think it just made like a really like pleasant sounding atmosphere. People got used to it, and I got used to it as well. And I was like, I kind of want to like reference these songs, and like that's when I like started realizing leitmotifs are a thing, you know. And like I kept like repeating melodies like in Main Menu and like in other songs and stuff like that.
The end credits are another place where familiar Minecraft motifs can be heard in spades. Indeed, reaching the symbolic end of a game designed to be endless is interesting in its own right. The music would have to live up to that moment, and fortunately, the lengthy end poem that concludes the game's mysterious narrative gave C418 plenty of space to make his point. Over a 10-minute runtime, Alpha, as it's titled on official soundtracks, takes you on an orchestral journey led by contemplative piano at its core.
Those are the credits, you know, like those are the only credits that we're going to get, and I wanted it to be good. At the time, I was in Las Vegas when they released the game, and that's when the credits came into the game. And like I felt bad because I actually haven't finished that yet, you know. So I think at the time I like released a free album of like, hey, I'm so sorry, I feel so bad. I was not very good at orchestrations at that time yet, so it took me like a month or two to make that song.
Once you've reached the end and defeated the Ender Dragon, the game's main survival mode becomes purely a playground for your whims. What drives survival, as the name suggests, is a constant need to gather resources and maintain your own health. In creative mode, those responsibilities are replaced by pure inspiration. Instead of having to collect or craft everything you might need for a build, creative mode hands it to you on a plate, allowing you to indulge your imagination without limits. C418 composed specific tracks for creative, which were eventually added to the game through a dedicated music update in 2013. The six pieces that score the mode all differ quite strongly from the minimal gameplay tracks, introducing upfront beats, more layered arrangements, and far longer running times.
I always wanted to make creative mode music. Ever since when we started having online mode in the game, there was only creative mode, and it kind of bumped me out because the music I made for the game was basically for survival mode, and it made no sense in correlation to what I was seeing because it was a colorful explosion. I was definitely inspired to make that kind of music just from the like very early stages of the game, when there was not even music in the game yet. I wanted the music to be long, and I wanted it to be like a bit meandering, like a bit like an optimistic, and I actually wanted to have percussion, which I actually was allowed. I don't think percussion fits into the main game as much.
It's true that percussion and beats rarely show up in the music of survival mode, but there are some notable exceptions. Among the more intriguing items you can find, albeit through some pretty awkward methods, are music discs. There's a total of 12 to discover, which can then be played on jukeboxes as an alternate way of generating music. In sound, they're definitely separate to the rest of C418's soundtrack, relying on a completely different set of instruments and styles.
I think I used 808s or 707s or something like that, like the Roland drums and instruments for like just the percussion. And like I used a lot of like mellotrons and like mellotron-like instruments. And like I always imagined that's what like the little people in Minecraft, that's the music they would write. I always assumed that like the music discs would be a sort of a modding kind of thing at some point. I think that's the twist I had back then. I don't know what people do with the music discs nowadays, but you know. I wish we would have like hidden the disc like better. Like I think the original idea for one of those creepy like the first the ambient sounds, we wanted that just to play in a dungeon somewhere like automatically. I guess that never happened. That's actually kind of a shame.
Music discs 11 and 13 are particularly notable for their lack of music, instead playing noises and ambience that seem to gesture towards something hidden. They've captured the community's curiosity since their first addition to Minecraft, and some fans are convinced that 11 especially references Herobrine, a mythical mob that's said to watch you from afar. Of course, there's no credible evidence of Herobrine's existence, and many who have worked on Minecraft outright deny he was ever included. However, C418 did include some Easter eggs in his audio through spectrograms. One is even used in the creepy music disc 11, which has only fueled some of the internet's crazier theories. Essentially, a spectrogram represents sound visually, and there are some surprisingly simple ways to hide images in music. With music disc 11, a spectrogram reveals a face, and the numbers 1, 2, 4, 1, and 8. Little more than the composer's digital signature.
Making a spectrogram is really easy. You just like Google for like spectrogram creator and you just put a BMP file in it and it gives you a WAV file. That's pretty much all there is to it. To make it interesting is you want to hide it within the audio environment so that it doesn't sound like, oh, this is definitely an image that I'm hearing right now. That's the part that is hard. Actually, Rich Reland, Disaster Piece, did a lot of it on his Fez album, and you can't hear it because he made it really quiet.
Considering that the music discs, survival mode, and creative mode all have distinct sounds, tying them together for an official release was never going to be straightforward. Then there's the fact that C418 continued to work on the project. Many tracks weren't added to the game until 2 years after the release of Volume Alpha, Minecraft's first OST album. Those new pieces were eventually released themselves in the form of Volume Beta, which also integrated most of the music discs.
I always wanted the soundtrack to be more than is in the game, so that like it's actually worth it to look into the soundtrack. I always like it to make it sound a little bit more like its own little universe that like you can separate from whatever product I worked on, you know? That was important to me for Minecraft. Like, that's why Alpha has a couple songs that never show up in the game, because those are supposed to be just for the album. I wanted like people to go like, oh, this is nice, this is more than was in the game, and it's that's pleasant. That was always like my intention. Beta was actually kind of weird because it's two albums technically, because I put the music discs in as well. And that was actually very difficult to separate. So like I put out like this little story and that like somebody like puts on a vinyl, and you can hear that in the soundtrack itself. And like at the end it stops, and you can like hear that it stops.
Volumes Alpha and Beta remain the only official soundtracks for Minecraft, though neither are exhaustive, and pieces have been added to the game since their release. We'll come to the potential third volume, which C418 is adamant about not calling Volume Gamma, later in this podcast, but nestled between Alpha and Beta came a whole other album tied to Minecraft. One. The album eventually became more of its own thing, but much of its content derived from music written for the official documentary, Minecraft, The Story of Mojang. Its soundtrack had plenty of the franchise in its bones, but a lot was done differently to give it its own flair. So, in what ways did C418 adapt his approach for scoring a film?
I think I was a little bit naive at the time as to what does it actually mean to make a whole soundtrack for like a film. Making music for film is 2D because there's a timeline and there's only so much music that fits in it. Making music for video games is 3D because you have to decide when the music plays, or like the player actually decides when the music plays, if they know that or not. So it was actually like quite difficult for me to like settle down and like not overwhelm the soundtrack and like have like silence. And I think I did that also with like repetition and minimalism. Like I made like maybe like four songs that are like kind of very loud and just like dancey music. And I stripped them off the essence and just took their melody and just like slowed it down and like sped it up, or like just like played with just the melody on a piano. And that's definitely something that I experimented with a lot. And at the time I also had a Game Boy that where I bought like a MIDI controller, so like you can strap the Game Boy just onto your computer and just like use your piano, MIDI piano, just to type in stuff into the Game Boy. That was really fun. That's definitely what I experimented with a lot.
The album that came from The Story of Mojang has a beautiful sung song at its end. Similarly, the documentary used it over credits, likely for its gorgeous mix of Minecraft's trademark style and the soothing voice of Laura Shigihara. Laura is a respected composer herself, having provided soundtracks for Plants vs. Zombies and her own project, Rakuen. Both of those games have upcoming episodes in this podcast series, and when I spoke to Laura, I asked about her collaboration with C418.
I think he didn't know it was going to be in the documentary. It was just for an album that he was working on. But he asked if I could write lyrics in Japanese for it and come up with, like, sing the lyrical melody part and put something together. And I also had a lot of freedom on that track. So I just kind of tried to think of a little story behind it based on what his arrangement made me feel. So I listened to the arrangement a bunch of times, and it had this kind of, I don't know, it was a very like sweet sounding track and a little bit magical to me. It felt a little bit kind of like a romantic sound. It was a very pleasant track. So the story that I came up with, which is a lot of times what I writing lyrics, is that the moon writes the sun a love letter, and the moon is very shy and, you know, saying things like, I'm alone, you know, like in this sky full of stars, and I miss you a lot, you know, but I'm just going to keep reflecting your light until you come back. So that was sort of what I thought of when I put it together. We did a couple passes back and forth, and when I heard the final product, I was like, oh yeah, I really liked how it turned out.
As Minecraft grew to unprecedented heights, the need for music beyond what C418 could provide started to press down. For April Fool's 2014, a version of the Game of Thrones theme performed by villagers played over the title screen. Additionally, villager-like sounds plagued in-game music and effects, taken from a resource pack by Element Animation. C418 himself had nothing to do with this event, despite being responsible for recording the original villager voices that inspired it.
I think I was very protective of my music, but so that at that time I was like, you guys do your thing, I don't really want to do anything about that. so that was just Mojang, and I think they talked to a couple of YouTubers. In fact, I'm disappointed that they never added the kid villagers, which I actually made very cheer for, but then they just, I guess they missed that, those sound effects, and they just pitched them up.
In the grand scheme, that one-off April Fool's event was minor, but Microsoft's $2.5 billion acquisition of the Minecraft brand was just around the corner. With it came an avalanche of new features and versions across multiple platforms. Online stores flooded with mashup packs, which completely reskin all visual assets and even present new music. An early festive pack actually included music by C418, found on Volume Beta, but all others went in new directions. If a pack concentrates on an established release, like Fallout or Skyrim, sounds from those franchises are used. But four mythology packs were given fresh OSTs by Gareth Coker. Why did Microsoft decide to go with a new composer? And how does C418 feel about it?
So I think what happened is they wanted me to make 3D LC music, like soundtracks, in basically less than a month. And I was like, listen, guys, I can only do so much. Which I assume is where they were like, oh, we have a couple internal Microsoft people, so we'll just take the next best one, which I guess was Gareth. Yeah, that felt weird. I'm still kind of uncomfortable about it, but, you know, I guess it's a living.
While Minecraft represented some of C418's first working games, Gareth Coker came to it from a much more established background. Gareth had already written music for games like In Momentum, Mean Green's Plastic Warfare, and Primal Carnage, not to mention his association with Ori and the Blind Forest, which released at a similar time to his debut mashup pack, Greek Mythology. His music is traditionally quite different to C418's, often making heavy use of orchestration. So was there any trepidation when taking on the job? And how much did Gareth consider C418's approach?
When I first started on this, I was like, okay, why did they pick me? Because honestly, my work is nothing like C418's. 4J Studios gave me the direction, was like, nah, we want you to do your thing. And I was like, well, okay. I think the main thing I wanted to get, though, with especially the mythology projects, one thing C418 does really well, he's not really hitting you over the head with the music. It's music that allows you to settle into whatever world you're in, and it gets you into a zone with what you're listening to, but it doesn't demand too much from the listener, but it's just enough to keep your brain engaged with what you're doing. I needed to find the orchestral version and synthetic version, because there's a lot of synth work in the mythology stuff. I needed to find the orchestral and synthetic version of that, basically. The one other thing that I was encouraged to do was add melodic elements to the music. But in terms of like a palette, that's probably where my work differs the most, because we got to use a live orchestra across every single mythology. I got to do some pretty cool stuff, especially with the Chinese and Norse mythology soundtracks, where I got to kind of experiment and use instruments that were indigenous to those cultures.
The space and minimalism of C418's music definitely informed Gareth's work on the mythology packs, but honing in on the different cultures they convey was the most important consideration. In Greek mythology, the whole Minecraft game world is transformed to resemble ancient Greece and its colourful legends. The soundtrack follows these inspirations as faithfully as possible, from its opening title screen. Historically, the Cyclos epitaph is known as the earliest example of a complete composition known to man. Written in ancient Greek notation on a stone column, its beautiful melody has survived at least 19 centuries, so we can still hear it today. Humanity had been writing music long before the Cyclos epitaph, but all we have of those songs are broken fragments. Appropriately, Minecraft's Greek pack opens with a stunning rendition of the epitaph, which dips players authentically into the mythology straight away.
You know, there isn't that much documented about it, but that, as you point out, is one of the first recorded pieces of music. You know, it was recorded to a tablet, I think. I was like, okay, well, is there a recording of what this sounds like? It's obviously public domain because it's millennia old, and I was like, okay, well, this is a pretty cool melody. Now I'm going to do my thing with it. There's some synthetic elements in there, there's some strings, and Aerly Brighton is the one singing it. And I was like, hey, this is going to work. Because we have the lyrics, have the melody. Honestly, it was a pretty easy place to start because most of the work was done for me. You know, I didn't write the melody and I didn't write the lyrics. So I'm really just arranging something that was already done. Now, what I did do was the harmony. The harmony is my own, but I really just got Aerly to sing the melody and then just added the production around it. And I do believe it was the first thing I presented to the Minecraft team, and they were like, yep, this is great. This will be the main title, and kind of draw on that, like what you've done for this, for the rest of the music.
To music nerds like myself, the Cyclos epitaph is essential listening. Gareth's use of it for the mythology's title screen was inspired, but drawing on ancient Greece precisely for the whole OST wouldn't necessarily lend itself to Minecraft's gameplay. Suffice to say that much has changed about our collective attitudes to music, which makes the majority of traditional Greek composition unable to make the transition to a 21st century video game. 19 centuries ago, the range of instruments available and how they interacted with each other are an understandably far cry from modern techniques, meaning total authenticity probably wasn't the best approach.
You don't really want, like, an exact copy of what ancient Greek music would sound like. Same with all the mythologies. Like, do we really need uber-traditional Chinese music, uber-traditional Scandinavian, Norse music? No, we don't. We want something that is still accessible to the listener but feels foreign. One of the first things that I suggested to, you know, the Minecraft people were like, well, you know, how about strings? Is that going to work? And they're like, yes. Okay, well, we've got strings. So that's something that's a little bit more what we know. But one of the things that I did take, and one of the things that there are a lot of in Greek music history, there's a lot of harps, there's a lot of plucked instruments, and there's some unique percussion instruments that are unique to Greek times as well. So it's about just kind of mixing and matching, taking enough of the ancient Greek elements and then combining them with a modern aesthetic and then trying to make that work within the context of the setting of the game.
For Chinese mythology, which released next, Gareth was able to take a closer look at specific Asian instruments and how to use them. Aside from a personal association with appropriate textures through living in Japan, Gareth had much greater access to the right tools for the job. In general, popular culture has a keener ear for Asian melodies and how they're written than it does for ancient Greek. This meant that Chinese mythology could form somewhat quicker than the others, even though it made much less use of synthetic elements.
Here's a fun fact about Chinese mythology. It was written, composed, orchestrated, recorded, mixed and mastered, 75 minutes of music in the space of 3.5 weeks. So having lived in Japan, I had access to much easier access than otherwise than I would have living in Europe or America, because I was so close by. I was able to travel to Korea, to China, to multiple other Asian countries and get a feel for the culture. And I had a greater understanding of Chinese music. Plus, there's just a greater record of Chinese music, and they've done a great job of preserving their cultural history. So it's just a lot easier to track down and find out what this music might sound like, what scales they're using, what instruments they're using, and then put it all together and create an album.
Instrumentation is a large reason why Chinese mythology sounds Chinese, but it also owes a lot of that sound to the melodies they play. Generally speaking, scales and modes are sets of notes that help define the feeling of a composition. For example, major scales are often used for upbeat music, while minor scales are considered darker. They can vary greatly, including all 12 notes in the Western octave for a chromatic scale, or a mere 5 in pentatonic scales. Such pentatonic scales are a cornerstone of Asian folk music, and Gareth used them liberally for Chinese mythology.
A scale is really just a defined set of notes that you limit yourself to. There's a much more technical way of describing it, but that's how I view it. And different scales, I find, have different characteristics, and this extends into modes. Scales are one thing, modes are a variation on scales. Different modes and different scales can elicit different feelings from the listener. But at the end of the day, it's just a choice of notes that you're limiting yourself to, and they can be very, very useful when it comes to writing music. The pentatonic scale is limited to 5 notes, hence why the word pent is in it. And this there's multiple ways of using a pentatonic scale, but Chinese music uses one pentatonic scale, Japanese music uses a different pentatonic scale. There's obviously some cross-pollination there, but one of the things I like about the pentatonic scale is when you're limited to 5 notes, there's obviously a limit to what you can do melodically and harmonically, so in many ways it actually makes the job easier.
Each mythology pack brings with it its own cultural idiosyncrasies, showing just how versatile Gareth's music can be. When it came time for Norse mythology, which takes its cues from Viking and Scandinavian sources, the music morphed again to make room for the huge horns and reverberating drums we associate with Nordic legends. Unlike Chinese mythology, this soundtrack is grim, looming, and at times, unashamedly epic.
Well, it's the biggest brass section I've ever hired. This was my biggest concern going into it. I was like, how big do you want me to go for this? And they were like, we want you to go big. And I'm like, well, big isn't really Minecraft. And they were like, we don't care. And I'm like, okay, well, that's fine by me, because I can do big. They wanted Norse mythology to stand out as, you know, really this quite big and quite dark and quite aggressive mythology. Greek one was fairly serene. Chinese one is kind of fun. There's a couple of darker elements to it, but it's still relatively light. But they wanted the Norse mythology to feel darker than any of the others and heavier. I just got a really, really big brass section, and there's orchestral elements too. There's also some custom like goat's horns that you hear in the soundtrack, which I did a ton of processing on to make them sound even larger than life.
All of Minecraft's mythology music uses a blend of live and synthetic elements. But it's mainly the live ones that inject an added layer of authenticity. For Chinese mythology, a large number of Asian instruments were front and centre, but Norse mythology concentrates on orchestral sounds above all, and Gareth made great use of them in some intriguing ways. An ominous, breathy scraping is just one of those techniques, which most noticeably appears in the Nether, a hell-like realm of fire and torment.
So the way to do that is just to get any stringed instrument with a bow and put the microphone as close as possible. It needs to be a microphone that can do this, but get the microphone as close as possible so it really picks up all of the grinding and the nuance and the nuances of the bow actually hitting the string. It's less about capturing the sound of the string and more about capturing the sound of the bow and that grinding effect. But it's a very cool thing when done right, because it adds a rhythmic and percussive element to the music, but it's not a typical percussion element.
Perhaps the most left field of Gareth's four mythology soundtracks was also the last to see release in-game. Egyptian mythology leans less on cultural norms from the Old Kingdom of ancient Egypt, instead honing in on the tropes of Western cinema set there. As previously mentioned, genuine music from the time wouldn't work for a video game today, so looking to popular movies for inspiration seems natural. That means, even though Egyptian mythology explores the oldest era of them all, Gareth's OST for it is arguably the most recognisable.
They wanted like an old school classic Hollywood sound, so like Prince of Egypt, that kind of Romancing the Stone, those, even The Mummy was a reference, like the kind of classic soaring Middle Eastern sounding score. It is a little bit tropey what I've done, but it totally works in the context of the game, so it doesn't really matter. Plus, we're just trying to bring people into the world rather than... We're not trying to reinvent the wheel. What they really wanted was soaring Middle Eastern sounding melodies, and they wanted it to feel larger than life and grandiose. And it does feel like a score that represents, I don't know, Cleopatra. I think it sounds luxurious is how I would describe that soundtrack.
In order to convey that luxury, Egyptian mythology uses thick strings and hypnotic rhythms, topped off with a surprising amount of guitar. Almost always strumming beneath the surface of the music, plucks and twinkles help drive the whole album as it unfolds. Gareth's use of guitar works as a double-edged sword, evoking musical trends of the ancient Middle East, while also tickling at our modern sensibilities.
When they said they wanted like a Hollywood sound, I was like, oh, okay, well, I don't really want to like do completely old school. But guitars and plucked instruments are especially common in Middle Eastern music. If you played other games set in the Middle East recently, you'll hear plucked instruments and strumming a lot. And you know, there's cool things you can do with guitars to make them sound a little bit more foreign. You can just take them out of detune them slightly, and already they sound like, you know, they sound foreign and slightly different. And I just think they also provide a little bit of extra momentum to some of the cues. It doesn't need to all be sweeping strings. It can just provide a little bit of push forward while listening to the music.
All four of Gareth's mythology mashups follow their own paths when it comes to tone, instrumentation, and even melodic movement, which was a lot to juggle in a relatively short space of time. As a result, their productions also differed, relying on separate levels of synthesis and orchestration, depending on the project at hand. Just how much of each soundtrack is genuine performance, and how much is synthetic?
I think Chinese mythology is the one where it's like 95% real. Norse mythology is probably about 80%. Greek mythology is probably 50-50, and Egyptian mythology is probably about 80% as well. But Chinese mythology was the most organic one, I feel. It's really only the percussion that is synthetic in the Chinese mythology. But all of the other elements have some kind of blend, and that's kind of a signature of my music anyway.
While it's true that real playing dominates every mythology but Greek, Gareth rarely physically performs on his soundtracks. Sticking mostly to composition and production, he often writes specifically for the practiced talents of soloists instead. As such, a number of names were involved in the mythologies, playing instruments as varied as Chinese winds, English horns, and even the complex nickel harper.
Normally I'm hiring people that are much better at playing the instruments than I am. Rachel Mellis did all of the winds on Chinese mythology, and then Karen Han played the erhu, which is the Chinese violin, and she especially was unbelievable on Chinese mythology. The soloists are always kind of pick and mix, and like whatever's the most appropriate for the project, but actually for every single mythology, it's always been the Nashville Scoring Orchestra. So it's the same orchestra that played on Ori and the Blind Forest. They have played on every mythology since the beginning, so it's kind of cool to have that consistency as well.
For performance, Gareth had gotten consistently great results from the Nashville Scoring Orchestra, but synthesis is entirely his own expression. In that setting, what are some of his favourite tools, and what's his philosophy behind using them?
I tend to not go too crazy on the synths. I'm of the school that when it comes to like synths, I'd rather have like two or three and learn to use them really well, rather than like hoarding a bunch of software synths. And I'm not on the hardware synth train, so I don't have like 20 different keyboards. Don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with that, and some people come up with amazing results. But I feel like if I did that, I'd probably end up tweaking too much. I think Omnisphere is fantastic, especially since you're now able to import your own samples into Omnisphere. The sound design potential is you're only limited by your brain. There's really just no excuse for not being able to come up with something even slightly original. Plus, they just keep on expanding it. I mean, the 2.6 update came out a couple of months ago, and it's just added like 2,000 more sounds or something ridiculous. The UHE synths, Zebra, Diva in particular, but also Hive, are really fantastic. Those are really the main ones. A lesser known one that I really like is Chromafoam, which is done by Applied Acoustic Systems. They do modeled versions of like tonal percussive instruments. It's a really fun synth to play around with.
Over his four mythology albums, Gareth puts his skills and equipment through a multicultural gauntlet that really magnifies his versatility. His fifth Minecraft album, Battle and Tumble, puts even more focus on those strengths, presenting a compilation of music from minigames and skin packs. The battle and tumble modes are exclusive to the Legacy Console Edition, but owe their concepts to fan-made multiplayer modes known as Hunger Games and Spleef. The official versions added to Minecraft's console ports brought brand new compositions by Gareth with them, including several themed tracks for individual maps.
That's a pretty wild album as a listening experience because it's kind of all over the place, but we didn't want to make separate albums for each mini game. So we just kind of put them all on there, and it's just kind of, it's a journey through a lot of different skin packs. So it's really kind of like a pick and mix.
Battle mode alone currently contains 21 different maps, and they all have their own character. Some gesture back to the mythology mashups, while others reference holidays like Halloween, but one takes an extra leap of creativity. Shrunk, as its name suggests, messes with your sense of scale, spawning players in a huge, oversized bedroom. It's a quite stunning design that emphasises the vertical, forcing you to climb rapidly between its multiple layers. A frenetic pace is only encouraged by the music Gareth wrote for Shrunk, which even uses ladder-like movements through playful arpeggios and scales.
All they told me about the Shrunk tracks, my first submissions for that, I failed pretty dismally. And they just kept saying, we need it to be faster, we need it to be more frenetic. And I'm like, okay, well, we're now at like 180 beats per minute and it's still not fast enough. Because a lot of those tracks are at 200 or greater. And I was like, okay, well, they need it to feel fast. Let's just experiment. We come back to scales now. If you listen to the music, there's a lot of scale patterns. Not necessarily scale patterns, but arpeggios, broken chords, and they're all going in multiple directions. But they're also supported by some kind of melodic element. In a lot of those tracks, the fast movement just comes from simple patterns going up and down, and I think that's probably what you're hearing that makes it feel like the ladders thing. I think it might actually be a happy accident, because I don't think I was thinking about that. It was more like, how can I make this more exciting to the team at 4J Studios? And the ladder effect comes from the contrast of things going up and down. Things going up and down fast are more interesting than pitches staying in the same place being played fast. This is why scales are fun to listen to when you hear them played really fast, because you've got it going up and then coming down. That's more interesting than something staying in the same place. So it's about trying to create as much dynamic range as possible within the composition itself.
The battle maps, and their soundtracks, have huge differences depending on what texture pack they use. Ruin and Invasion both use the official City texture pack, which is geared toward producing impressive architecture. For those areas, Gareth got his first real chance to go all-out electronics since starting work on Minecraft. On the Battle and Tumble album, there are more city-based pieces than any other individual texture, totaling 5 tracks of cool, dark synths and beats.
they said they wanted more of a cyberpunk feel for those, and I was like, okay, well, that's very different again. There's a lot of arpeggiated sounds in that, and one of my favorite synths for arpeggiated sounds is, it's a lesser known synth called Zeta, spelt Z3TA, but it's a wonderful synth for those short, sharp tonal sounds. But I'm sure there's a lot of Omnisphere in there, because Omnisphere has like 12 million sounds, and you can also create your own as well. So it was kind of a fun thing to do, because it also allowed me to experiment with a little bit more of a retro style of writing as well, because there is some synthetic elements to it, but it is also more of a retro style as well. It's not super modern in terms of the synths, in terms of the synth production.
The only theme on the Battle and Tumble album to have more tracks than City's five offerings is the tumble mode itself. Again, like everything on the collection, Tumble's music has its own style that cleverly mirrors the game mode it scores. The objective is to be the last player standing while simultaneously taking others out by removing blocks. It results in energetic matches fraught with tension, matched by Gareth's intense compositions.
If you listen to Tumble Mode, almost all of the sounds are short and staccato and percussive, so there's a lot of energy generated by that. And again, they're all just really fast tempo tracks. That actually wasn't too difficult. It was just difficult because the tracks were so fast, and I had to write 12 or 10 or 12 of them, I think. It's just a lot of notes.
Along with the City, Shrunk and Tumble tracks, Gareth's fifth Minecraft album features music for Fantasy, Steampunk, Frontier, Halloween and Festive skin packs. Together, they form a colourful and diverse web that perfectly fits each texture. But what does such variety do to a composer? How does Gareth balance all those different styles, especially with tight deadlines looming over his shoulder?
It kind of focuses the mind. I actually prefer tight deadlines, to be honest, because you can't waste time overthinking things. I think that's the key. Not overthinking is the key to delivering quickly. When you have a lot of time, it's cool to experiment, but you can also end up outthinking yourself and then getting away from what actually the best solution is. This, you have to find the best solution quickly and then replicate it. With all of these different skin packs, once you find the first track, it's like, okay, well, that works. Let's do two more like that. You know, I've done one fantasy track, time to do two more in a similar style. For me, for all of these, once the palette was established, it was like, okay, well, that's the palette. Now I know what to do. And some of them, you know, it's like Halloween. It's kind of obvious what to do for Halloween. It's kind of obvious what to do for the festive stuff. Frontier is, you know, it's typical Ennio Morricone Western style stuff. It's just a case of finding the palette, and then you're limited to the sound, so a bunch of sounds that you've chosen. So then you've got less decisions to make on the follow-up tracks.
Minecraft was in good hands with Gareth Coker, and the five albums he produced in a short time for the game's DLC are underappreciated gems of VGM. As I record this podcast, he's working on Ori and the Will of the Wisps, which fans hotly anticipate after the much-loved original that he also scored. By the update Aquatic in 2018, which added whole new depths to Minecraft's oceans, the title's main composer returned with three gorgeous, fluid synthscapes. C418 hadn't contributed music to the brand since 2013's tracks, From Volume Beta. His new compositions, Dragonfish, Shinichi, and Axolotl, not only validated an already expansive update, but delighted players with their soft and swelling calm.
You know, actually, I think I just sat down and like I created those songs in a flurry of like 4 days or something like that, and I barely remember it. And I think it's because that I've been doing it for like 9 years now, and it just comes to me. Like, I don't even have to think about it, and that's kind of weird, actually. That probably means I should probably do something new.
Personally, I'd rather C418 continue releasing music as long as he's able, whether it's for Minecraft or his own solo releases. As I mentioned earlier, a third OST volume has been expected and teased for quite some time, tentatively, though erroneously, thought to be titled Volume Gamma. If it comes, it'll probably feature the update Aquatic tunes, alongside a host of unheard material. So what's its current status?
I hope I can release that album. There's some licensing things that are going on, and I don't deal with it. It's like lawyers talking to each other. I don't know when I can talk about the third volume anymore. But I hope I can release it.
Whether or not Volume 3 ever sees release, his existing soundtracks for Minecraft helped define his career. With such a free environment to explore creative whims, the game allowed him to hone and discover his style, which he's continued to develop on other projects since. Through working on the brand, his music gained incredible exposure, but listeners fell in love with it on its own merits, and became fans of C418 as much as Minecraft itself.
I think, and it might be like, it might be a bit ignorant or something like that, but I think I created my audience myself. Minecraft helped, but like I never really had any help from Microsoft or Mojang on the marketing end, you know? Like, I did all of that myself, and I'm kind of proud of that. I tried to be as independent as possible, and I guess because I still make enough money to just live off of my like Spotify and iTunes stuff, and that's actually very freeing. Like, I actually have the chance to say no to projects that would make me uncomfortable. Which is why I only now am starting to work at a company, because it took me that long to find something that I actually really enjoy doing. I guess Minecraft did allow me that freedom to just do that in the first place. Every once in a while I wake up and sweat and I'm like, oh god, I'm gonna be bored by tomorrow. And then I look on Spotify and I'm like, oh shit, people still listen to it. Okay, I think it's okay.
With Minecraft's unmatched popularity and obsessive fanbase, there isn't much worry that people will stop listening to C418 anytime soon. His branching, ever-growing soundtrack is continually listed among the finest modern game scores, with particular attention drawn to its unique approach, careful pacing, and memorable melodies. In its many versions, the title is truly summed up by its music. C418's inventive approach, which ignored generic formulas, tied his melodies and textures to the experience on a deep level. It helps players foster emotional connections with their personal worlds, and masterfully sets a tone that encourages imagination. By bringing Gareth Coker on board, its DLC packs and bonus modes were given a significant jolt, offering curious gamers a vault of diverse tunes to enjoy. At the release of this podcast, Minecraft is already stacked with extra material, and more is certain to come.
Look at the amount of ground that's been covered, and it's kind of really exciting to me that they've been able to push the boat out musically and really, really experiment with lots of different sounds in the Minecraft world. It just kind of illustrates the amount of variety that they put into Minecraft since I started working for Minecraft.
Music is the arguably the most important part to nail the atmosphere. And that I think is even true if the game has no what we could call music. Like, if it's just sound design, that to me can be music if, like, you do it right. And I think that is the most important part, like, for the game to, like, be interesting. I don't know, like, even puzzle games can be so much more interesting if you nailed, like, the audio acoustic environment, you know? So, like, I think audio is very high up there. It can, like, bring you into the game or take you out completely if you screw up.
Thanks to C418 and Gareth for speaking to me for the sound test, but thank you too for taking the time to listen. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please make sure to follow or subscribe on whatever platform you might be listening on. This second season of VGM Podcasts is set to be far bigger than the last, featuring several console deep dives, explorations of individual games and series, and genre-specific specials. There will be a new episode each week, with next week's delving into the classic fantasy world of Fable, covering every game in the series with composer Russell Shaw. All my Patreon supporters gain early access to that edition, no matter how much they pledge. So head on over to patreon.com/_secretcave if you'd like to show your support and hear next week's episode right now.